From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
All right, we're here, we're back, and I'm glad to have you with us tonight. Blink from Blink on Crime is here, and we're going to be talking about all sorts of things. But first of all, welcome her back to the show. How you doing, kiddo?
I'm well. How are you, Dana?
I'm doing good. Did you have a good Easter? The Easter Bunny come visit you, or what?
We did. As a matter of fact, I took a few days off. The kids were all on spring break and did a whole bunch of family things. I was glad to have it. How about you?
Good for you. Yeah, same old here. The Easter Bunny's getting old and gray, but he still hops around a little bit, so... Anyway, listen, we got lots to talk about. Of course, Blink is our sister blogger here at Scared Monkeys at blinkoncrime.com. And we're going to talk a little bit about everything. We're going to talk about the Powell case, Sandusky, that crazy sheriff, ex-sheriff down in Denver, you know, the meth for sex ex-sheriff. That's a bizarre story. But I want to talk about our mutual friend Pat Brown and her book, Only the Truth. Of course, Pat's going to be on right after you, so we have to be nice to Pat, even though she won't be nice to us. No, I'm kidding. Pat's a sweetheart, longtime guest. I know she's a friend of yours, and you did a review of her book, something a little different for you, on the site. Let's talk about Only the Truth.
I did, and I was flattered to do it. I mean, we all know Pat's work through, you know, criminal profiling and the professional side of things, but this was her first foray into a fictional offering, which was a psychological mystery, and I really enjoyed it. She did a great job.
A fiction foray. See, say that three times real fast.
A fictional foray.
Good grief. Anyway, Pat, probably one of the more popular guests on my program for a number of years now, speaks her mind, is not a stranger to a little bit of controversy every so often. But this takes it down a little different path. We see a whole new side of Pat Brown.
I agree with you, and I didn't write this specifically because I really wanted to focus on the content. And it's not a long book, so I was a little concerned about going into different characters and, you know, the whole spoiler alert.
Sure.
But I did note that clearly, you know, her background and, you know, profiling potential criminals and crimes helped her a great deal. I think showing the other side of the coin, if you will, showing the perspective from somebody that may or may not, again, I'm working under the spoiler alert, that may or may not be guilty of a crime, and how, you know, our collective kaleidoscopes need to really be open to looking at all of the information and not rush to judgment, which is really, it's kind of akin to so many cases that are going on today.
How do we get this book? It's a Kindle, and I know Pat was giving me a hard time last time she was on because I didn't know what the hell a Kindle was. I thought that's something you light when the lights go out, doesn't it? Or I don't know what that is.
You don't need, what's great is you don't need a Kindle, which is a handheld kind of a reader. It's like a handheld electronic book.
Right.
That you can subscribe to many different applications and or publications. But what's great about this offering is you can download it to your smartphone or your PC, and you don't need a Kindle to do it. So you could just literally download it, what's called a Kindle reader, and read it just like you would any other book online, or download it to your smartphone. In fact, I downloaded it to mine, and I did it, you know, on my appointment day where, you know, we do the girl things like hair, nails, that kind of thing, where I can't stand sitting still to begin with. So at least I have something in my hand and I'm feeling like I'm accomplishing something.
Sure.
So that's nice for that.
The in this story, we're going to jump around here a little bit, Blink from Blink on Crimes here. The Joshua Powell, you call it the Joshua Powell backstory. Every time I see those two little boys' picture, it just makes the what little hair I've got left on the top of my head stand up, because it is such a failure of the system. such, and I got to watch my language because we're on public access TV here too, but
right.
I don't want them bleeping every second word out. This story is something else. What's new with the Joshua Powell backstory?
Well, you're catching me in between two pieces. You read the part one.
Sure, yeah.
Where and we're working on, and it's delayed a little bit simply because we've got access from the courthouse, from the Spokane County Courthouse, to over 800 documents that we've been going through that, I mean, when you say a failure on the system, there's a couple failures at play here. There was a failure on the system inside the Powell home yeah. when Josh was a child and his siblings. One of our contributing editors, Leah Connor, who was also a family attorney, who was a practicing family attorney in Washington, who obviously didn't have any, you know, clients or input into this case. But when I'm working and I'm asking, you know, questions about these things, she has never even seen some of, you know, what went on for years in this case. And that's a bit what we're going to talk about, a couple of things. We're going to talk about the unbelievable filings and family dynamics that went on in this home, which should not surprise anyone, really, as to what Josh Powell turned out to be. And moreover, nobody's going to understand how, when he was being evaluated prior to the determination from his evaluator that he needed to undergo a psychosexual evaluation, the facts that he gave his interviewer are additionally incorrect and verifiably wrong. Mm-hmm. So before the West Valley Police Department stepped in and said, wait, we want you to see these images, you know, after they got the original report, and then it results in the new judge's finding saying we need him to do a psychosexual evaluation, which many believe, Dana, are the reason why he murdered his children and took his own life.
Right.
He knew it was over. He knew he was going to have to potentially undertake a lie detector test. He was going to have to go through certain exercises and tests that if he did have pedophilic tendencies, which, you know, 400 images of that were found on his computer. And I just want to say that that was five were actual photographs, and the rest were, I'm sorry, five to six, and the rest were some sort of animations depicting, graphic warning here, like incestuous
right.
conduct with children. So under the law, is it grainy that they were all considered, you know, chargeable offenses in possession of child porn? Correct. However, to his credit, the gentleman who was doing his evaluation, you know, did kind of a halt. We need to take a closer look at this. I have some concerns. While he did that, because he really didn't have a choice, as I said, you're going to see, he asks him some questions in his evaluation that are contained in the files that have previously never been released publicly. And I have concerns like you shared.
Yeah.
Why? It seems at every turn, these children, Charlie and Brayden, were absolutely failed. There's no reason that I can see if they had, you know, pornographic images from his computer before he even left Utah to go to Washington, why a Child Protective Services inquiry wasn't launched there.
Yeah, it's just, and we all know what happened and with the little boys, and I guess for the audience members that aren't up on the case, let's talk about what happened to these little boys.
Well, ultimately, they were Stephen Powell, who, by the way, if you'll note, and we haven't discussed this at length, but if you'll note that I had some concerns that when he started talking about being romantically linked to Susan Powell, who is the missing wife or of the late Josh Powell.
Right.
When he started talking about that, I had some serious concerns that he might be involved in her disappearance or some sort of, you know, de facto situation with her. I wouldn't think of another reason why anybody would ever say that. In other words, potentially if she was found, there may be some link to him via DNA or something else. Well, it has recently been released that the weekend, December, I want to say 6th through the 9th of 2009, that Susan went missing. I'm sorry, 2008, that Susan went missing, that he actually called off of work. Now, he works largely from home.
Right.
But he called off of work saying he had an emergency for those 3 days. So he's unaccounted for.
Yeah.
And it coordinates with a few other witness depictions. What ended up happening to Charlie and Braden is as a result of Steve Powell being served a search warrant and pornographic materials and charges found on his computer in his home. This is separate from Josh. What happened was the children were removed from the home and placed in state custody where the Coxes, who would be Judy and Chuck, Susan's parents, their mother, were given custody. They were very vocal. The Coxes have always been very vocal that they feared Josh would harm the children. And what we were able to determine is not only were they afraid, but Susan put a letter in a safety deposit box in 2008 for the reader to know that if she were to die, even if it looked like an accident, that she wanted her death investigated. She had fear that he would harm her. Josh would kill her. And she was right.
Yeah.
Ultimately, when Josh was told that he had to have a psychosexual evaluation in February of this year, and he would not be able to regain custody with the children until he did that, in my opinion, he had started the pot for the possibility, the planning for the possibility that that might happen, but he lost it. He was not going to be found out, if you will,
sure,
as
yep.
to the kind of person that he was.
Yep.
He was going to take those children with him. And when social services came to, he did have to have supervised visitations, dropped the children off, they ran ahead of her, he locked the door with them in the home, he struck one of the children with a hatchet in the neck, he struck another one in the neck and in the head. However, both children died of carbon monoxide poisoning.
Yeah.
So they did not die. But he did, you know, the social services worker said, I heard him say, as I often heard him say, hey, boys, I have a surprise for you.
Yeah.
And that's how they met their death.
God.
Their father hitting them with a hatchet in their tender years. And they, you know, they bled and died in a house that ended up blowing up.
Yeah. Tortured to death
by a
bastard that doesn't even deserve a place in hell, let alone anywhere else. Blink from Blink on Crime is here. We're going to be bouncing around a little bit, talking about different things. And one of the stories that you're writing, and you've been busy here lately, is talking about Pat Sullivan. And you know me. I'm pro-police no matter what they do. When you see the Drew Petersons and all the dipsticks that once wore the badge and disgraced the badge out there, I'll go after them just as hard as anyone. But this poor old guy, 69 years old, and I'm saying that facetiously, he's one sick puppy. Let's talk about him.
I'll tell you. I had to write on that. Have you ever seen Breaking Bad?
Yes.
Okay. It's a favorite show of mine in that it's really kind of shocking. It's like that, what do you call it, like a guilty pleasure, because it's so
right.
austere and crazy, but it's brilliantly written and brilliantly acted, and you just can't believe it's even happening. And frankly, if it actually did, if it was based on a true story, I probably wouldn't watch it.
Right.
But when I saw that case, I was right there. I couldn't believe it. This man was a law enforcement officer with an esteemed career. As you saw, they named the correctional facility that he is now in after him.
Yeah, jeez. Wow.
I mean, where does it... It's like you can't make it up. He is the luckiest prisoner that I'm aware of to date, because as I understand it, when he was arrested, first of all, several of the charges against him were dropped. There was actually two different episodes, if you were to read the indictment carefully.
Right.
Which means that he had allegedly two proposed encounters that were to be paid for by crystal meth for male sexual favors. And his task force went from 11 to 18 and included a federal investigation. So I'm not positive that this is over.
No.
I'm guessing it isn't, because he did plead, because it certainly was not his attitude going into it. And if ever there, I mean, the audacity of a law enforcement officer to break the rules like that and then think they're going to come out of it smelling like a rose, I had to write about it. It was outrageous.
Well, it just makes your skin crawl to see this dirty old man. And you wonder that, I call it a position of trust that he was in. And you know what? Even when you hang up your badge, you're still in that position of trust. God, they named a jail after him, for heaven's sakes. And hopefully they take that plaque down pretty quick.
Actually, Dana, thank you. They have.
Oh, have
you
they?
Voted? Yes, they have. That is very recent, in the last few days.
Oh.
Sheriff Grayson, who is the sheriff in that territory now, I don't recall if he's his predecessor. Successor. But he did, they did vote to change it, and they will, and they have.
Good.
I don't know that they've renamed it. I just know that they voted to rename it. But, and what you're saying is so true. And that's one of the reasons why I feel compelled to write about it. Positions of public trust, in my opinion, should be treated differently than almost any other type of offender.
You bet.
The abuse of public trust, whether that's a clergy person, whether that's a civil servant, as a law enforcement officer, or what have you, they are looked upon differently by citizens. And the vulnerability, in my opinion, increases to a citizen when that happens. And I also think the responsibility is different.
Yeah.
And you're exactly right. This gentleman absolutely abused his power. He was on the National Committee for Crime Defense under Bill Clinton.
Yeah, he was a tough cop.
Sheriff of the year.
Absolutely.
Before he retired.
Yep, he was a tough, no-nonsense cop, but obviously the elevator never went to the top floor with that dude, and he's got some serious problems, and he'll have to hopefully spend some time in the jail that was once named after him. Blink from
right.
Blink on Crime is here, and we're talking about some of the stories that she's writing about and the cases that she's covering. Check out her blog at blinkoncrime.com. Now, I know you haven't written about it, but you've been writing about it, and because the comments are coming, and it wouldn't be Blink.
I know.
You know where I'm going with this. You know where I'm going. Trayvon Martin, Zimmerman. What a story. The race baiters are out there, the Al Sharptons, the MSNBC kooks. All you have to do is, if you have any lick of common sense when you follow the story, and of course we're not hearing everything yet, and there'll be more that comes out, I'm sure, but listen carefully to the 911 tape, not the edited one that NBC put out, but the 911 tape. When you hear that dispatcher tell him, don't follow. Please don't follow
right.
him. Stop that. That, as far as I'm concerned, is the case here. That's the whole case. Cosby has come out and talked about guns and all that, and, you know, he's partially right. But I would be remiss without asking the Blinkster about Trayvon Martin and Zimmerman. What are your thoughts?
My thoughts are, first of all, I want to commend Mr. Cosby, because I think
yes.
he's done a good job at trying to defuse, you know, what I call the political opportunity that presented itself to Reverend Jackson and, is he a reverend still, Al Sharpton?
I'm not sure what either one of them are, but yeah, okay, we'll call them that.
Okay. One of the things that upsets me is, in my personal opinion, first of all, Mr. Zimmerman is Latino.
Yes.
He's not a Caucasian.
Nope.
So I'm not sure how profiling another minority works in the scheme of media, but it did. You know, and in my opinion, exploited the situation, which was already bad. Mr. Zimmerman, as you pointed out, has a big problem. He, you know, there's a 17-year-old child who is dead, who was unarmed, who he was told to stand down.
Yep.
He was put in a position that he should not have been in. He was carrying a weapon he should not have been in. To me, this is cut and dry. That said, I don't believe that Trayvon Martin was profiled because he was black.
No.
So there was no racial issue. Now, one of my posters brought up a critical issue, and to your point, Dana, no, I was not going to write about it, and I'll tell you why. I have learned, just through watching, when you have, when the political, you know, firestorm bursts out of a case like this, I know that the facts go by the wayside, and it becomes an emotional issue. And I know that that is something that, you know, promotes cause in the political arena. Let's face it, there's nobody better at understanding how the media works. And, you know, let's talk about Red for a second. And him and I have not discussed this case, but I'll be honest with you. One of the first things that I thought of when I started seeing this momentum was the murders, to contrast, of Channing Christian and Christopher Newsom.
Yep.
Are you with me?
I'm with you.
Okay. I was incensed at the lack of coverage of that case, which was absolutely a racial case. That case in particular is so profoundly brutal and violent, the media wouldn't even touch it. And they'll tell you that. But it's still, and they should have, not from the racial perspective, but because it happened. And you can't have it both ways. Either you're going to cover or you're not. So for me, I didn't cover it because it's such a, you know, in all of the things that we do and in our particular niche, I like to think that we, you know, promote advocacy and we make a difference in some of the cases that we're able to profile and cover. For this case, it's so racially charged, I feel like people are not even paying attention.
No.
I really don't. I feel like they mean well, don't get me wrong. But once you infuse, you know, race, emotion, you know, point fingers, you know, you get political opportunists in there, nobody's really paying attention to the real issues, which are exactly what you said. That man had no business doing what he did. And I will point out that he's being represented by guess whose lawyer?
I don't know.
Joy Ray.
Oh. Oh, wow. Well, there
Mark
you go.
Mark O'Mara was Joy Ray's lawyer.
Wow. There you go. And Neighborhood Watch. I've organized Neighborhood Watches. They have a vital place in protecting lives and property. But, you know, Florida's kind of kooky when it comes to some of the laws that they have down there. And dangerous, Orlando? Yeah, sure, absolutely. But this cat should not have been carrying a gun. He should have listened to the, I thought the 911 operator did a good job. But let's talk a little bit about NBC and editing that 911 tape. They're saying it was an accident. I say, as we like to say up here in Canuck Land, horse hockey. No way.
They inappropriate.
Did. Yeah, no way.
Inappropriate.
Yeah.
You cannot, I mean, really? They're partially responsible for some of the firestorm that went on here.
Absolutely.
And when is the media, you know, the mainstream media, by the way, when are they going to be held accountable for, you know, this incident and the checkbook journalism problems that they're having? You know, Dr. Phil paying for repeat autopsies, paying the Anthonys. I'll tell you when people start to say, listen, you know, I'm calling you out. I'm not, you know, if you're going to be the, you know, the media-based finders of fact, if you will, and putting out information, then you need to be accountable.
You know, I absolutely. Red's just sent me a quick email. I'm supposed to tell you, you're spot on, as usual. So that's good.
We've had that in particular, Shannon Christian and Christopher Newsom. That case, there's a few cases that haunt my house that I'll just never, you know, they drive us. They shape the way that we work in advocacy and in investigation. And that case in particular can keep me up at night like almost no other. Maybe the Lunsford case would be close.
Yeah, no, that's true. And, you know, and I remember interviewing Mark Lunsford shortly after. the case, and he was talking to me about how things change so fast. One day he's with Jessica and teaching her how to ride a bike, and when she falls off the bike the first time, how he had to bandage her knee, and then the next thing you know, we've got a monster out there that buries her alive.
In Florida again. Not to point fingers at a state, but I will say this: in Sanford, in particular, where this is happening, there has been what I would call an increased number of incidents where there is questionable law enforcement tactic.
Yeah.
And I'm being as generous as I can be. It happened in the Chris George case. It happened in a few cases. That particular, I want to say, the former chief was moved out of his position because his kid kept up on, you know, booze or drugs or what have you, beat up a black homeless man, and I almost wrote about it, but I had so many curse words in it that I thought, you know better than that. You need to not write about things that you're that passionate about that you can't be objective. So there's a little bit of that going on down there too. There needs to be in certain areas, and I'm going to say in Seminole County in general, and it might just be the fact that I've covered a lot of cases that kind of dip into that area, so I have a really good understanding of it, and maybe a cross-section in any state looks like that. But for me, there's just a lot of, I think that they would do well with, you know, when you contrast that with Orange County Sheriff's Office, which is in Central Florida.
Sure.
North of them, who I feel, you know, has done an excellent job in the past in cases that I've worked on. When you contrast it with that, it kind of makes you wonder, you know, do we need some oversight here?
For sure. Blink from Blink on Crime. We're down to 30 seconds. One of the guests I'm interviewing tonight after Pat Brown lives in a small community just outside of Chicago. A very small hamlet, we like to call them up here. They're finding out and they're fighting now a proposed for-profit correctional facility that's being built in their community without any say that will house illegal aliens. I didn't think that the Obama administration arrested any, but there must be some that are going to jail. I'm going to get in trouble for that, but that's okay. That's okay. How do you sell it to the folks? I like to call them Joe and Mary Sixpack out there. That all of a sudden there's a big jail being built in your community across the street that's going to house sex offenders, that's going to house illegal aliens, that's going to house murderers, and expect those people to open arms to say, yeah, this is great, and then a for-profit. I just can't get my head wrapped around that. Your thoughts quickly.
I'm not going to have an answer because I wouldn't. I wouldn't be sold on that at all. I mean, you're talking about the depreciation of people's personal property. You're talking about, you know, the fact that that area is now going to be an increased security risk. You're talking about, you know, the fact that that has to be built there. So there's a level of, you know, the reality is there's a level of, you know, illegal workers that do that.
Oh.
You know, there is in our government. So I'm not saying that that's right or wrong. I'm just saying if people don't, I think they're smart enough to take a look at that.
Oh.
So my answer is, I don't know, Dana. You would not be able to sell it to me, so I'm not sure that I would be able to present a case where I could sell it to anybody.
Well, I'm going to hopefully help these people get some PR. Blink from Blink on Crime. Always a pleasure, ma'am. Thank you.
You too, my best, dear.
Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye-bye. That's Blink from Blink on Crime. Check out her blog at blinkoncrime.com. We're going to take a break and be back here shortly with Pat Brown, criminal profiler, the author of what we were just talking about, that book, Only the Truth. And we're going to carry on with the discussion on Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin and anything else we can think of. And then after that, like I said, a fellow by the name of Christian Anderson is going to be here. And we're going to talk about that proposed correctional facility. Geez, I know I'd wake up in a sweat if I heard that was coming to my neighborhood. This is the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. Out of all the criminal profilers named Pat, my next guest is my favorite, Pat Brown. I don't know how many criminal profilers are named Pat. Do you know?
I don't think there's any other. There's so few criminal profilers that I think you can count them on one hand.
Well, you know her, you love her, you can't live without her. Pat Brown, criminal profiler. You see her on all the crime shows. She does her own work. She's a semi-regular on my program. Of course, she has her Kindle edition of the book, Only the Truth. Blink and I were just talking about it. How's that going? We've talked about the book before. It's a great book. I've read it.
Well, thank you. It's going well. I mean, I'm getting people who are reading it are loving it, and that's always exciting for an author because it's a funny thing when you write a book. You just have no idea how other people see it.
You know,
until they start commenting back, and you go, oh, my God, they see what I wrote. They see the characters the way I wrote them. They're excited by the twists in the story, and then, you know, it's working. It's working. It's really working, and I'm excited about that. So they really seem to enjoy it. It's a really heartwarming story, a story about love and faith, and a crazy woman who we say whose name is Charlene. We go, what is wrong with that girl? And why is Billy Ray even thinking about hanging around her? So yeah, they're enjoying it, so I'm real happy.
Well, exactly. Only the Truth, that it's a Kindle edition that you can get. The links are in the show notes. Pat, I brought you on tonight to talk about Trayvon Martin, the Zimmerman case. You know, even Cosby's getting involved now and making comments. And actually, I agree with some of what he said. But let's take this from the start. The race baiters have been out there. The networks, some have spun it. You know, even poor old NBC had to edit some audio to get some attention with it. But this is a bottom line. The dispatcher told him, don't follow him. He was packing a gun. It's tragic. But there's, you know, we haven't heard the whole story, but I want to get your thoughts on the case.
Right. I think the biggest concern that I have is, let's say that George Zimmerman is guilty. Let's start with that. Let's say he's guilty. Let's say that's the conclusion of the court.
Yep.
At some point, because the evidence proves he's guilty of a second-degree homicide. In other words, let's say that in the future we do not find any evidence that Trayvon Martin ran after him and, you know, knocked him over the head or jumped him from behind. We find no evidence that he was attacked. Let's assume that this is true, that George Zimmerman decided to follow Trayvon Martin, when the police dispatcher told him not to. Let's say he profiled him,
right,
whether it be racial or not. Let's say he did all these things. And let's say he did something and it caused a collision between the two and he ended up shooting the child.
Right.
Okay, let's assume this is all true. Let's even assume that Zimmerman turns out to be a racist. Now, he said something racist. It's not that he is racist. He said something racist.
Right.
Okay? Here's the problem, in my opinion. If he did all these things, the man has a personality disorder.
Sure.
I'm not going to say he's a psychopath because I always use the word love, but let's say he's got a personality disorder. People who have personality disorders look for ways to feel big. They look for ways to get power and control, to be the hero or to be the bad guy or to be whatever they decide they want to be. Some of them want to get back at society. Some of them want to be God, in a sense. So they want to be something grandiose. And they often will pick whatever happens to be useful to them to make themselves feel that way. We look at the Norwegian killer, the guy that killed the 77
sure.
people, including a good portion of teenagers. You know, he's standing up in court, and he's got 5 days in court to say, I'm not feeling guilty at all. All these kids deserve to die, and I'm only protecting the country.
Yeah, jeez.
What a bunch of hogwash.
Yeah.
And people are saying, well, this is what right-wing people are all about. And I'm like, no, this is what a psychopath is about. He's just picked up on this argument to justify being the superhero in his own mind and to be important and to, just like a mass murderer, any mass murderer wants to go down and have his name in the newspaper. So one mass murderer says he's killing off these people for one reason, and another mass murderer comes up with a different reason.
Yeah.
But the fact is, when you come down to psychopathy, they have no empathy for anyone. And a lot of times they're all, you know, they really don't have the same kind of quarrels other people have because they haven't grown up with that kind of thinking where they're truly caring or truly involved in any side at all. They'll just pick one for the fun of it because it's useful to them. So this man, if he did do what he did, may well, in my opinion, would have a personality disorder. And I think he was a wannabe cop.
Yep.
That's what he comes across as, a wannabe cop.
Exactly.
Who decided he was going to be the protector of the neighborhood, and I, you know, he went after this kid because he wanted to be the hero and instigated something that ended up with a child being shot to death. I think he's probably going to, you know, if the evidence does not put Trayvon Martin in the picture of turning, you know, running after him and doing anything to him, I think he's going to, that evidence would support that he's guilty of second-degree homicide. But why did he do it? I think it's more because he wants to be, you want to be important. Not because the Trayvon was black. Because he wanted to be important, and then maybe another day would have been a Hispanic guy, another day might have been a white guy.
Yeah.
We don't know. He just wants to be important. And so I think we're mixing up one possible personality disordered individual with something rampant in our society that we need to then address with this kind of venom. And I think that's where I feel sad about this divisive racial stuff going on when we're talking about one guy with an issue. You know, it's not everybody. It's one guy.
Yeah, and that's a good point. Pat Brown, criminal profiler, is here. When you look at that, this is one individual. It could have been a white kid in a hoodie. It could have been a Hispanic kid in a hoodie. Like you say, you got this neighborhood watch guy. Of course, the laws in Florida are goofy anyway, but let's set that aside. Packing a gun, following around somebody, not taking the advice of the 911 operator. And that comes out, and you know, there's some edited audio. The race baiters come out and start grabbing that. Even poor old President Obama comes out. If I was to have a son, he'd be like Trayvon. Why do people grab the story without knowing all the facts and then comment on them right away?
Yeah, it's just been very disturbing from the beginning that it's been made before the evidence was in, or whether it's, again, just one person committing one crime, that we're going to push it one direction or the other to say this is a racial crime, and we're going to have to then pick sides of whether we believe it's a racial crime or don't believe it's a racial crime. I think a lot of times people want to appear sensitive.
Right.
And concerned. And they don't want to end up on the side of the guy that's a kind of, you know, maybe a creepy dude. You know?
Sure.
So if you say, hey, maybe let's give Zimmerman his day in court. Maybe he didn't do anything. You know, maybe after we heard him huffing and puffing toward Trayvon Martin, maybe he just turned around.
Yeah.
We don't know the evidence yet. Maybe Trayvon Martin looked over and said, "What's that guy? Who's that guy that thinks he has the right to even come toward me?" You know, he thinks he's just going to go walk away. Oh, I don't think so. He goes up the back and says, "Hey, you," and grabs George Zimmerman. George Zimmerman turns around and he punches him in the face. If that's true, George Zimmerman is, you know, if he did not approach Trayvon, is not guilty. And he would be protecting himself. But we don't know that that's true. But what happens is people, because George Zimmerman didn't come off looking real good to begin with, you know, there was that immediately jump. We don't want to go with the guy that, you know, is stalking this kid on the, you know, in the neighborhood. And because the kid is black and the Zimmerman's white, and we don't know about his racial issues, you know, we want to jump on board and say, you know, here's this innocent kid. But you know, I guess, you know, having raised myself, I'm, you know, raised two biracial kids and one black son. And I just read this thing in the Washington Post, which drove me nuts. It was all about how Trayvon Martin's father gave him the race talk, how he had to expect in his life he was going to experience all these negative things. And then other parents jumped on board. They had to quote some of their parents. And one white parent of two biracial kids said he had to have his wife do the race talk because he didn't understand what his kids were going to go through. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, what's going on here? I never gave my kids the race talk, and my husband never gave it to him either.
Yeah.
I guess we must have forgotten that talk. We gave our children a different talk. I call it the talk. The talk was, when you leave the house, you are a member of society. You're a citizen of the world. And when you leave the house, you're to present yourself in a way that makes people comfortable, that makes people look at you in a positive way. And so when you leave the house, you know, I would tell my daughter, if you left the house dressing like a hoe, people are going to say, you're a hoe.
Right.
And if you leave the house looking like a thug, black or white, or mixed race, people going to think you're a thug.
Right.
If they do not know you. If they know you, they'll just go, hey, there goes one of Pat Brown's kids looking like a thug. We know he's not, but he's looking like one. But if they run into somebody who doesn't know them, and especially because my kids were homeschooled, if they were wandering around in the middle of the day, which I did not allow for that reason, people might think, what's this kid doing out of school looking like a thug near my house?
Yeah.
So I taught my children their responsibility was to present themselves well to the world when they went out. That was the talk I gave them.
And
they have never encountered any problems in their life. I'm not saying they haven't heard a racial slur once or twice here and there, you know, but they didn't give it over import. You know, they just said, okay, the guy's a jackass, and they walked away. And consequently, they've grown up healthy, happy. They never had problems with the police. Now, my daughter is the police,
yeah.
So, you know, so I didn't put them in that negative frame of mind. I put them in the frame of mind of being human beings and to approach people well and to speak well to people and not scare them and smile and have a good face on you, and then people respond well in return.
Well, it may sound corny, but the old saying, treat people as you expect to be treated yourself, is...
Exactly, you know, and if you walk down the street and you're walking in a purposeful manner, dressed in a decent way, with a pleasant look on your face, people do not think you're up to no good. Unfortunately, a lot of teenagers, black and white and Hispanic and Asian, I don't care what they are, there's a lot of teenagers who just look like they're up to no good. I can understand where Zimmerman thought that, because I've seen them in my neighborhood. I mean, I don't do what Zimmerman does. I don't take my 9mm, put it on my body, and go walking down the street and start following some kid who's not committing a criminal act. That's where Zimmerman went wrong. He had no right to do that. But I can understand the original theory of, you know, I don't know this kid. He's standing around looking like he's up to no good, you know, which a lot of kids do when they're, you know, dressed in a way that, you know, makes you wonder whether they're, you know, well, they are thuggy kids, you know. And I don't know what Trayvon Martin looked like that day. I don't think we actually know what he looked like that day. You know, we've seen wonderful pictures where he looks like a handsome young man.
Yep.
Just a charming young man. We've seen pictures where he's, you know, he's got his gold things, his gold teeth thing going, his gold grills going, and he's, you know, throwing the finger up in front of his, you know, Facebook page.
Sure.
But hey, he's a kid. He might do stupid shit like that.
Yep.
And as I say to my kids, you know, if you're going to be stupid, do it in the house. Just don't take it out.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I don't know what Trayvon Martin looked like when he was in that neighborhood.
Yep.
How he was behaving. So I don't know, like, why George Zimmerman profiled him as somebody up to no good. What I do know is George Zimmerman didn't have the right to tail the child like a police officer, because that's a threatening thing to do.
Yep.
He also can't bring a gun to a fist fight. So if he started something up with Trayvon, and Trayvon threw a punch at him and, you know, because he was protecting himself, or both of them, they just started pushing each other and started throwing punches, you know, just because you're losing the fight, you don't get to pull out a gun and shoot because you're losing a fist fight.
Exactly.
That you can't do. So there's a lot of behaviors that we need to be teaching our children, not because they deserve to get shot, but because we don't want our children to become victims, and we have to teach our children how to stay safe, and that part of their responsibility is to not be menacing to the neighbors and not to have an attitude that, you know, upsets people. So I just think we need to teach all our children that, just because that's a nice thing to do and it's a safe way to be, and your children can grow up a lot happier than if they have a chip on their shoulder, thinking everybody's out to get them, and always seeing a negative where maybe there isn't a negative. It's, you know, not even a big deal. One of the experiences I had was when I crossed the border, once from Canada, and I had my children in the car, and my husband was not with me. So as I was crossing the border, and the border guard looked in my car, saw my children, and he said, "Are those yours?"
And
I looked at him and said, "Well, I always thought they were."
Yeah.
And he broke up laughing, and I, you know, obviously what he was looking at was wondering whether I was ferrying illegals into the country.
Sure, yeah.
Now, I could have started a big, huge, you know, border, should we have a big, huge, I don't know what you'd want to call it, some kind of march on the border, that I was being profiled, my children were being profiled, I was being profiled as an illegal immigrant smuggler, you know. But all the guy was doing, he was, you know, he's a border guard. He does see stuff that goes on.
Yep.
He does question. It's kind of normal. So I knew he wasn't being mean, or he wasn't, you know, being a horrible person for profiling. The situation as a possibility. And I just made, you know, I told him the truth, and he laughed, and I went home, and I didn't even think about it.
Exactly.
It was funny. It was just funny. You know? So I didn't go and make a big deal over it. So I think we have to make sure that when we're going to make a big deal over something, that it's something that is happening constantly, that we don't have any responsibility in. You know, when the KKK was hanging people from the tree, there's an issue. We got to do something about that. I mean, there's no question about that. And there's other racial things. We do need to step up to the plate and deal with racial inequality. I'm not saying we don't. In a logical, you know, and reasonable fashion. But not when we just blow one incident out of proportion and start, you know, making it, you know, just, I think it is blown way out of proportion, and I think it's sad because I think it's causing so many problems it shouldn't be causing.
Absolutely. You know, if you want your ducks in a row, make sure you got them all in a row, you're going to look like a quack. Pat Brown, criminal profiler, always a pleasure, my friend. Talk to you soon.
Thanks a lot, Damon.
Bye-bye. Yeah, Pat Brown, you know, just got an email here. She's a class act, and that's for sure. Okay, we're going to take a quick break and come back. Can you imagine waking up to find out that there's going to be a prison in your neighborhood? We're going to talk to Christian Anderson about just what's happening in his community. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. Again, think about this. You live in a small community. You live in a big community. You live in a neighborhood that's, you know, I like to use the term Joe and Mary six-pack. You're a family. You go to the ball game. You go out and water your lawn. You mow the boulevard. You think about your property values. You do what we're all supposed to do in life. All of a sudden, Big Brother comes up and says that they're going to build a prison in your neighborhood. A for-profit prison. God, I can't get my head wrapped around that term. It's going to hold illegal aliens or sexual predators or drug smugglers or murderers or whatever. How would you react? Well, Christian Anderson's here, and that's happening in his community of Crete, and I want to talk a little bit about that with him. Hi, Christian. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dana. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell us a little bit. I'm going to basically throw you the ball and let you run with this. What's going on in your community?
Well, as you alluded to, Crete, Illinois is sort of a typical, if there is such a thing, typical Midwestern American town of about 9,000. It's 30 or 40 miles outside of Chicago, and it's really where the suburb meets farmland in the Chicago area. It's a beautiful town. It's rolling hills in contrast to a lot of the flatness of the Midwest. It's horse country. There's a major racetrack located on the outskirts of town, and there are horse farms populating the countryside. The town itself is a quaint little town with a number of Victorian houses, antebellum-style homes, and one of the nation's showcases for the Sears homes that were constructed out of kits that were mailed across the country in the 20s and 30s.
Right.
So it's a very peaceful place, and about a year or so ago, the town fathers, the village officials, sort of entered the lottery, as it were, a federal sort of lottery, and put themselves in the running to site a privately run immigrant detention facility here.
Okay.
This is a facility that would be about 788 beds. It would be a medium security facility with three levels of detainees. And with recent trends in the Obama administration's enforcement of immigration policy, they're prioritizing people who are not only immigration violators, but also convicted felons or people with several serious misdemeanors. So they're people who have served their sentences in prison in the United States and then are scheduled for deportation, and they would be brought here to Crete in this facility that's yet to be constructed, indeed yet to be approved by the various parties. And the partners in here would be the Village of Crete, which contracts with a firm called Corrections Corporation of America, which is, as you mentioned, a for-profit prison company.
Yeah.
That runs about 60 prisons, if I'm not mistaken, across the United States, mostly direct contacts with government. The fathers, the village officials sort of put this on the radar about, I would say, 6 months ago. They went public with it, but in a very low-key way. And it took a while, but January of this year, the local citizens really got wind of it, and there was sort of a firestorm of opposition and a lot of presence at local meetings and a lot of other actions in the community, which is really amazing because it's really a pretty conservative place A lot of families have been here three, four, even five generations. It's one of the earliest settlements outside of Chicago. So it's been quite a ride these last few months.
What is the town council or those in charge saying now that the media's got a hold of this and the public are voicing their displeasure?
Well, this is a difficult time for municipal governments across the United States. Many are struggling with revenue coming out of the recession. Tax revenues are down. Expenses are up. And so the village officials really, when we first approached them asking very serious questions about this enterprise, pointed to the revenue gains. And indeed, it's a fairly expensive facility to construct, and because it's a privately run facility, they would be charged property taxes to the tune of about $1 million a year, which would be spread upon the four or five different taxing bodies that are, you know, in this region here. But it's a nice little revenue hit for the local government, but many of us feel that this is blood money.
Right.
Others just have a problem with the negative effects of a prison in their community, and others just don't want our town known as a prison town.
Well, again, I can't get my head wrapped around the I'm sorry to interrupt. Get my head wrapped around the for profit part of that, and I'll ask you that in a minute. But what the public is saying makes sense, and the, you know, those elected officials are there to represent the public, unless I got my social classes wrong when I went to school many years ago. What are they saying to you now? Revenue aside, I know cities are trying to make money rather than to hold the line, so to speak. What are they saying to the folks, and what are you folks wanting?
Well, I believe that the mayor and the village trustees here in Crete are trying to also get their minds around the profound implications that an institution like this has on a town, especially of our size. There's a lot of evidence to that points to many negative long-term effects that more than offset the revenue we would gain here. In other words, prisons and prison-like facilities tend to have the effect of stifling any further economic development
sure.
in a small locale like ours. Businesses don't want to necessarily move in. There's not necessarily a lot of money to be made from having 750 prisoners in your town. There's negative effects on the image of the village, and so people move out. People don't want to move in. So I think they're... We've tried to talk to them very directly about the sort of long-term. We've shared with them a lot of academic studies about prison siting across the United States and the economic and social effects that are documented. And I think for a while they were looking at this as just another, as you kind of alluded to just now, a sort of just another economic development project. When we first, when people first protested loudly, they were sort of like, well, we, you know, they complained when we brought a McDonald's to the outskirts of town, you know, and we're sort of, this is not a McDonald's, hello, it's not a fast food joint, it's
yeah, exactly.
a prison, you know. And so they got caught up in the nuts and bolts and the money and look at the revenue it'll bring in, but I think they're starting to really reconsider the wisdom of this decision. At least I'd like to hope so. The opposition has been growing and it's been consistent. And there's a very, very packed house at every village board meeting with a rotating cast of citizens from all walks of life. You know, the funny thing about this is that many of us would probably disagree about immigration policy in this
sure.
country. But I think we agree that it's a broken system, and we don't want this sort of, you know, warehouse for broken hearts and broken families that are a product of a broken system in our town. We just don't want it here. We don't want the national focus. This is an extremely divisive issue in the United States, as you probably know, and it just brings with it a lot of controversy and a lot of negativity. I personally don't think that this is the right approach to immigration. I don't think, and I have deep reservations about the for-profit system, and I think a lot of us in Crete have not paid much attention, but we're educating ourselves to the pitfalls of that system. I've come to the belief, I really haven't thought about it that much, but this punishment is part of the judicial system. We would not outsource our courts to a third-party for-profit system.
Exactly.
And we cannot do it with this branch of the judiciary. This is the punishment phase, and it's a governmental function, not a private function.
Absolutely. Christian Anderson's here just for the last couple of minutes. Is there a petition or something that the folks can do?
We've presented a petition a couple of weeks ago to the town council with more than 1,100 names on it. We're continuing to plan a door-to-door canvassing drive in the coming weeks. There's some legislation in our state capitol that may go a long way towards deflecting and actually putting an end to this project. For 20 years, Illinois, the state of Illinois, has had a law against for-profit prisons, a law that states that the state or local governments cannot contract private prison companies. We have a philosophical stand against that in the state. However, there was seemed to be a loophole in the law that did not cover these sort of immigration detention centers, which hold mainly people that are considered civil offenders, in other words, not criminal offenders. Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, this particular facility would hold both, would hold criminal offenders as well as immigration violators. So I'm not sure where I was going with that, Dana.
Yeah, that's okay. And you could tell your heart is in this. You can protest that McDonald's at the end of the block, like you were saying, or that whatever that's going down the end of the street. The people have a right to come forward and ask the questions. But again, this whole, like you say, immigration issues aside, this whole idea of for profit and this whole idea of a small community like yours looking at that first injection of revenue but not looking at the long-term picture is just a head-scratcher. And, I wish you guys all the luck. And feel free to pass on this interview link to everyone involved. And what's the next step? Is there another council meeting coming up?
Well, the next step is hopefully Illinois will pass this law that plugs a loophole, and that will help a lot. And we are also going forward with another door-to-door petition drive. Our congressman is helping us set up a meeting with the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Administration, which would be the federal agency overseeing this, because we have a lot of hard questions to ask them. So we're continuing to press the case, and we really appreciate you having us on tonight to give this issue some more visibility, because all we can do is get out there and register our discomfort with this approach to immigration, and especially here in our little town, our beautiful little town.
Absolutely. Stay in touch. I will with you, and we'll have you on again for an update.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Dan.
Thanks, Chris.
It's been a pleasure.
Take care. That's Chris Anderson from Crete, Illinois, and I don't know, maybe I'm getting old-fashioned, but for-profit prison, I've never heard anything so stupid in all my life. That's it. That's tonight's show. I hope you enjoyed it. We're here at scaredmonkeysradio.com 24/7 for live programs, podcasts, comments, you name it. We're here. We do the show for you and only you. My name's Dana Pretzer. We'll see you again real soon.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.